Hello, everyone, and welcome to Now Spinning, the official podcast of the Lansing Community College Vinyl Record Club. We meet twice a month to listen to vinyl and talk about music. Stay tuned to learn about how you can get in touch with us and attend our meetings. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Now Spinning. With me today, I have...
I'm Steve Robinson.
Jacob Zokvik.
Leo Ackerman.
And Simon Medina. Welcome back, Steve. We're just here last week. We talked to you about your musical past, all that kind of stuff you
were
listening to.
What a great conversation. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, go tune in if you haven't heard it. Indeed. Please go listen. Please.
It was good. We talked. You guys asked great questions.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about the kind of music that you were influenced by when you were growing up and that kind of stuff, what you're listening to now. But today I thought we'd take kind of a deeper dive into that and ask you, you know, what records you would bring with you to a desert island. That's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, you know,
sure.
Desert island record.
Sure.
But you know, I was wondering, like, when you hear that, what do you think of?
Well, I think of Impossible Choices. I think, you know, record people were big on lists. And, you know, the other thing I think of is you could ask me this question at different times of the day or different parts of the year, and the answer would be different. So I struggled with it. And before I answer, I can answer. I brought 10 records, figuring, depending on how they ask the question, I might pull something different out. But for actual physical LP records, vinyl records, I sort of have two main veins that I listen to. The records I bought, literally, a lot of the records I bring to Vinyl Record Club, I bought when I was a teenager. I bought before I could, you know, I had a driver license. My mom or somebody take me to the record store and buy them. And so they've sort of imprinted on me. And that's all the post-punk stuff that we talked about. I also, in my office, I have a turntable set up that I have for years and years and years. And in there, I listen to mostly mid-century jazz. That's, you know, jazz from like the mid-50s to the mid-60s. As it turns out, if I could do two, not just one desert island record.
We got plenty of time for that.
Yeah, it has to be one of those things where you love every second of the record. It really hangs together as a unified artistic statement. You didn't give me any rules, but I'm a sort of self-imposing, like, no greatest hits, no anthologies, right? Because that seems like cheating. It's an album.
I love greatest hits.
Oh, like, I think
that
greatest
was
hits
how
are good.
I discovered
but Jacob,
music.
Don't you think they're cheating for Desert Island?
You gotta respect the format. You have to respect the
No.
You gotta.
If I was being dropped off at a desert island, I would bring a greatest hits probably.
So you'd also be the one to bring like a book of short stories or something, right? Like if this were novels or films or something, you're not gonna watch like 6 minutes of one movie and 8 minutes of another, right? So, anyway, these are the rules I'm imposing on myself.
All right, fair enough.
So, you gave me leeway of more than one. I'm going to try to do two.
Sounds
so
good.
On this stack of 10, I mean, if you gave this stack a name, it would be like records I couldn't live without. And unfortunately, I could add a lot to them. But if it's like, take 10 records, I think these are it. But I grabbed two. And I'll make a distinction. So we'll start with Brian Eno's Another Green World, 1974. You guys know how much I love Brian Eno. So the binary I have here is this is a record where we're talking about the studio as an instrument. I haven't heard you talk about it on the podcast, but I know the club, we listen to Beach Boys, we listen to a lot of 70s pop where, you know, artists turned the recording studio into one of the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not written out the way it is. The whole creation process is part of it. And, you know, Eno didn't do this alone, but as a producer for all the artists that I've heard you talk about and love, this is a great example of an artist using the studio as the instrument. And I love every second of this record. The first four solo records for Brian Eno after Roxy Music are indispensable for me. But there are not a lot of like songs on this. And it's also not ambient. It's just its own thing. And I love Another Green World. So I know you guys know a little bit about this record, but that's my first one. The studio as an instrument. I don't want to be the only one talking.
No, it is interesting. Brian Eno really was, I mean, from what I know, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but Brian Eno, from what I know, was super early on in establishing sounds that literally could not be played live.
Yes. Right.
Like effects that you could not recreate live, even if you tried.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his like early 70s work Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy.
Also, a record I can't live without. I mean, that's an amazing record.
Here Come the Warm Jets, you know, another one. I mean, like, yep. his initial run in the 70s is almost untouchable from both, like, a songwriting standpoint. He was the keyboardist in Roxy Music, right?
Yeah, but he often didn't use a keyboard. He was played the synthesizer. And if you, like, pull up some YouTube videos of Roxy playing on, like, Old Grey Whistle Test or German TV, and you look at his synthesizer rig, sometimes it doesn't even have a keyboard. He's just twiddling knobs and patching things in.
Wow, classic and Moog style.
So yeah. Super early on, like, modular synthesis.
Absolutely,
stuff.
Absolutely. And he also, you know, was big on this, you know, the non-musician making music. It's not this one. It's more Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. He's got the Portsmouth Symphonia, which is this famous group of amateur musicians playing out of tune, out of time, on purpose. It just sounds great. So the whole novice or being new, and there is this artistic thread of finding the beginner's mind, right? I think that's a part of what Eno always wanted to do. He wanted to, and he also just loved to sing. Early on, he said, I made these records because I like to sing. He still leads like an a cappella singing group of just regular people.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very cool.
In the UK.
That's interesting because, you know, this album, I've listened to it quite a bit. This is probably maybe my favorite Eno record of what I've heard so far. But there's not a lot of singing on this. Like I think there's like one song near the start where he sings on it, but the rest of it's really just...
Yeah, I'll Come Running, I think, has got...
There's a couple, I think.
Right. And they're very textural, right?
Right.
And, but these are musicians, you know. Like Robert Fripp has amazing guitar solos on this. Like, I mean, I love every track of this record from beginning to end. But there's a tune on here called St. Elmo's Fire, right? What is it? Yeah. And the Fripp guitar solo on there is, it sounds new to me every time I hear it. Every time. And so I love this record.
You mentioned texture when describing this record. I think another really admirable thing about Brian Eno and the thing that makes this record all the more essential is I think Brian Eno was also very early on in discovering that texture is as important to music as melody is or as like rhythm is, especially his work with, like you mentioned, Robert Fripp, like the Fripp and Eno records.
Unbelievable. No Pussyfooting, all that stuff. And Fripp is on most of these records.
And he goes on to work with him on like the Talking Heads records he produced. There was this Live in Paris Fripp and Eno record. I've never heard anything like it in my life. I think his exploration of texture was as groundbreaking then as it is now.
Oh, I agree. And another one of the piles, this is sort of cheating, but another record in this pile is his collaboration with David Byrne, the My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which is very textural record, but also in, you know, pre-digital, like sampling and, you know, remixing, and that record's really groundbreaking. But I think you're right about texture. Another Green World is as much about texture as anything else. There aren't a ton of melodies. I'll Come Running to Tie Your Shoe has a great kind of hooky melody, but mostly it's things coming in, things coming out, things layering. I couldn't tell you how many times I've listened to this record.
Ties back into your, like, using the studio kind of thing, too. I think of, what's the song off of that first album?
Some of them are old.
Some of them are old. His vocals on that are layered in
over and over again.
Just magical way. And, you know, like we talked about the Beach Boys and stuff, and they did it too,
they
right?
They did.
But theirs was very, very harmony focused and based, and which is amazing. Like, we love all of that Wilson harmony stuff. But Some of Them Are Old is like kind of like you said, textural. You know what I mean? It isn't just the harmony to it, because a lot of it, he's singing the same note, and he's just kind of like putting an inflection on his voice, you know, a raspiness or something, just to kind of fill out the sound behind it, just to make it like kind of overwhelming. You know what I mean? You hear so much at once.
Yeah, and, you know, he was also a visual artist, and he did the same thing with the cover of that record with Taking Tiger Mountain. They're like Polaroids of himself. So it's like what you said he did with his voice, he also did with his face. He's like one of my favorite artists, period. So this was my representative of all those great records where they're a creature of the studio. I mean, there's this dichotomy between what artists do in the studio and what they do either live or in performance, right? And so that's how I was able to only pick one. This is the representative of what artists do when they use the studio as an instrument.
Yeah, that's. I think you picked a very good representative
I
for that.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, and like you said, just like not just Eno, but again, all the artists he's worked with, but like.
And before, yeah.
One more thing, before we move on,
yeah,
about this record, but like especially with like a lot of records, is like I think that this one is able to like just conjure like not just like the texture, but like just like a feeling to it, you know, like I can't really describe it when I listen to it. Like one of the songs, like The Big Ship, there's no words at all in that song, but it's such like a very, it's such a powerful melody, you know, it just brings you to your knees. Like that's all happened to me.
It is, you know, and Eno isn't much of a piano player. He'd be the first to tell you that, but those chords, they're simple Brahms chords in first and second inversion, The Big Ship. And you know, even if you don't play piano, you could sit down and kind of figure it out.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes it so accessible. The one last thing, I almost brought them, Eno and a colleague of his, they made a lot of their artistic decisions based on these playing cards they built called Oblique Strategies. Mm-hmm. I have a set of them. Oh. And so when they would reach a place where they were struggling in the studio, they actually go into this card and it would say, make it darker or... find the thing you don't want to do and do it. I mean, these are the kinds of like the sort of almost vague or opaque, like go outside and scream and come back in. I don't think any of those are on the cards, but those kinds of things to kind of change artistic direction. Not only are they using the studio as an instrument, they're improvising with it as well.
There's a real sense of play to everything
absolutely.
Eno touches.
Correct.
It's almost this like childish wonder.
Yes,
yep.
That's it.
Yeah, it is. It is. I feel that this record represents that. Yeah.
Whimsy.
Whimsy. Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah. Great.
Very whimsical.
So you're in second choice?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I figured to go in the exact opposite direction. So this is probably a record that I have listened to as many times as this. This is Bill Evans' Sunday at the Village Vanguard, 1961. And it is the exact opposite of using the studio as an instrument. This record could only happen at one moment in time, a particular Sunday in June of 1961 in the basement club in Greenwich Village, the Village Vanguard, which I've been to a few times, and I'm going again in a couple of weeks. It's like a jazz time machine. This room is still set up the way it was when this record was recorded.
Awesome.
Without the cigarette smoke, I think. right. So, but here in contrast, this is a record of something that happened and then will never happen again. The saxophonist Eric Dolphy has this great quote about music. He says, "The thing about music is once you hear it, it's gone. In the air, you'll never capture it again." So the music has been gone since 1961, but we have this record of it. And before we talk about the music that was captured there, unlike the studio, I am obsessed with how this record was recorded. It is often used by audiophiles to test their high-end systems, but it was recorded with like three microphones.
Do you know who produced this?
I do. So this is a Riverside record, and the recording engineer is a guy named David B. Jones, and he built a custom Ampex recording rig on springs that he could take down. And if you ever go to the Village Vanguard, you got to kind of cram down these stairs and around the corner. Not a great place to record. And I don't think we have a record of the exact microphones that we used, but they were brand new, like condenser type microphones, like Sony C37s, and not recorded in stereo, probably one mic for the bass. This is a trio, piano trio, piano, drums, and bass. And this recording is so simple that it sounds like you're there. There's no artifice except for Jones was prepared to capture great live music. You can't really do much with mixing it. They panned it stereo a little bit, and you can hear that. But this is a recording where you can close your eyes, and it's like you are there.
You can still hear the room.
Oh, that's what you hear. And the cool thing, not only can you hear the room, you can hear the conversations that people are having. The Village Vanguard is a very small club. It hit, holds about 125 people. You can literally hear a conversation this couple is having. You hear the cash register go. I have listened to this record so much, and I love it so much. That's the recording part. I do want to talk about the music part, but I wonder if you have any other things about it.
Can I sneak one in here?
Yeah, absolutely.
You said it's a record that could only happen like in this moment.
That's it.
I have a similar one from my childhood. So I used to, growing up, I wasn't as into music, and I just kind of figured it out slowly. Mm-hmm. And I was really into jazz because I was pretentious and I thought jazz made me smart, you know.
I think it did.
Sure. Thank you. But even now, love
it doesn't
jazz.
Mean you weren't pretentious.
Love jazz. Was pretentious. I'm still pretentious. Anyway, I can't remember the name of the album, but I got it as a CD as a kid. It was like The Summit or something. But it is Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong.
Oh, wow. Ooh,
and I believe they recorded together a couple times, but this is like the one.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked Duke and Louis.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Just the titans of jazz,
absolutely.
You know what I mean? Hearing that for the first time and just going like, I'll never get to hear this. Like, I'll never get to go see these people, you know, they died well before I was born.
Right.
You know, but that the moment of it and like, could you imagine like having been there and being like, yeah, I got to see both of them at the same time. Jeez. You know what I mean? And it happens with rock groups too nowadays where they'll do a show together and they do like one song, like one of the most popular songs of one of the artists, but they play it together and everybody just like loses their minds. And like, I think that's so special in that like live recording setting that like you can get just this amazing thing to happen and then people's reaction to it too, you know, and you're just like,
well, you all did an episode on live records and that was really cool, but you make an interesting point about jazz. This is an art form that is about like, this is the only time it will be like this, right? You don't want to play it, you know, the same way.
It's built on improv.
Yeah, definitely.
It's very true. No, I was just, the one thing I was going to mention about this is like, this isn't normally the kind of record I'd listen to, but I have heard this one a couple times before.
Oh, I'm so happy.
I was going through it was a book, but I found it as like a list on a website. It's the 1001 records you have to hear before you die. This was like the fifth one, I think, or something on there. And I quit after like 20 of them, but like this was one of the ones I heard and I thought it was awesome.
You can really picture yourself there. Let's talk about the music for a minute. So, there's another generational component to this. In 2025, when you listen to Bill Evans, it sounds like a lot of jazz pianists because everybody's been trying to sound like Evans, this very impressionistic chord voicings. You know, he famously was in Miles Davis's band and brought in a lot of these sort of European like Debussy and modal approaches. So a lot of pianists sound like him, but they didn't at the time.
It's like the Rachmaninoff problem,
exactly.
Where like so many people are like, I want to sound like Rachmaninoff. And it's like, yeah, I hope you have like 6-inch long fingers and can practice all day long.
Yeah,
but try, because it does sound cool.
The other thing about this, the other thing about this trio is, which was sort of new, the piano trio is probably, particularly in the jazz tradition, it's music stripped down to its bare elements. You know, Western music is traditionally about three things: harmony, melody, rhythm. And that's it. Got three people and that's it. And usually, you know, the bass player is prior to this was relegated to just walking and playing the fundamental. The bass player here, Scott LaFaro, doesn't stick to conventional time. It's very conversational. You can hear the they're all taking equal parts in playing these standards. Two of these tracks were composed by the bass player Scott LaFaro, and the reason for that is really, really sad. So this was recorded in June of 1961. He was 25, Scott LaFaro, and he was in Bill Evans's trio. He very promising career, and he dies in a car accident 10 days later. And nobody was doing with the bass what he was doing. I mean, like Ray Brown, probably one of the most famous bass players in jazz, when Scott LaFaro died, they said, this will set the instrument back 10 years. He plays it like a guitar. He plays in the upper register. He plays so fast. And he was largely self-taught on the bass. He went to Ithaca College as a clarinetist. He got into jazz. He picked up the bass, had a few lessons. His teacher was Red Mitchell. And then he went deep. He and Charlie Hayden, the bass player, were roommates in L.A. for a while. He had a very short career, but even today, the best jazz bassists who are in their 90s, like Ron Carter, will talk about Scalfaro, this guy who died in 1961, a kid, you know, 25 years old. So there's a little bit of a poignant thing about this record because this was the last record.
Wow.
That's would you say, we talked in the previous episode about your history learning the bass. Was this kind of influential and part of that decision?
Well, absolutely. Well, actually, I discovered this music when I started studying upright bass. It was my teacher who told me, well, you got to check this out. I was actually, it's interesting. We've talked about Keith Jarrett. I love Keith Jarrett, and I loved his Standards Trio. And I pulled in some of those recordings, and my teacher said, well, you know, those are great recordings. They're kind of still riffing on the great Bill Evans trios. So go back and listen to those. And the first record that they only recorded together for a little while because of Scott's untimely death. There are actually two records were produced from this one Sunday. They did a few sets and Sunday afternoon in the Village Vanguard. It turned into this record, another one called Waltz for Debbie. Which is a great record.
Yeah, that's the one I've heard. I did not know that was the same session.
Same session, same day. But then they put this out quickly as a kind of a memorial for Scott. And the Waltz for Debbie, I love that as much. In fact, there's a reissue of both of them together where they also have the recordings that Jones captured of them discussing their repertoire. It's so cool. You can hear like Bill Evans putting his pencil on the music stand and, you know, saying to Scott, I said, well, why don't we start with your tune? That one, you know, the new one, right? And that's the opening here is a tune called Gloria's Step. Scott's girlfriend was a dancer in New York. Mm-hmm. That's a tune about him. But they only did four records together. But to your question, the first one they did was called Portrait in Jazz, and they open up with probably the most recorded jazz standard, you know, Autumn Leaves. Mm-hmm. Play Autumn Leaves. The whole band goes through one chorus, and then they stop. And LaFaro plays the whole song form by himself, solo. And I remember watching my turntable like, oh my gosh, I need to quit the bass. I can never play that. It just rips your head off. And so I love those recordings. There are only four records, and two of them are from the same afternoon.
Wow. Could you imagine being like at that venue, just random one-off afternoon turns out two of them?
All the time since I was 18. I really, that's interesting. Yes, I have. When I listen to this record, I'm like, at first I was like, why are these people being noisy during the music? They should be quiet. They should be reverent. This is one of the best. And I'm thinking, they're participating. Like, they're cool enough to have known to go to this basement club, and they're talking, and they're probably smoking and trying to hook up a date and, you know, ordering a drink. And it's a participatory music. So I've not only thought about being there, but I've gone to that club. On my 21st birthday, my stepmom took me to New York. And I'm like, I got to go to the Village Vanguard. I spent, you know, more money than I had to get, you know, it's still not that expensive to go to the Village Vanguard, but there's a drink minimum, you know? And so I went, I saw my first show there. I saw Milt Jackson, the vibraphonist. We're going in a couple weeks, going to see Bill Frisell. That's going to be cool. Looking forward to it. But I've seen great shows at the Vanguard.
I think, like, especially this last record, I mean, it immortalized this guy who died 10 days later, this legend. And not only did it immortalize him and his bass playing and cement his legacy, it also immortalized the people in the room.
Yep.
There's just something kind of haunting about, like,
you're
the
listening
fact that they're preserved.
Ghosts.
Everything is preserved.
Absolutely.
In amber.
Wow. No, that's it.
It's as it was that many years ago, and it will still be that way. And I don't know. There's something very captivating about, like, specifically a live performance to me.
I agree. And, you know, come back to that Dolphy quote, you know, it's gone in the air and never captured again. But I would encourage you to listen to this record and listen to it with one pass. Don't listen to the music. Listen to the people in there. You can hear them move. There are little pieces where you can make out what they're saying to each other. It could only have happened then. and there were only 125 seats there to be present when it happened. Mm-hmm. And so those are my two desert islands. One where the studio is the instrument, and one is like it's a capture of an event that we can fantasize about and to try to relive, but we weren't there and we'll never. There were 128 people who participated in it, and we just have this shadow that's left.
Awesome. Wow.
Those are some great picks.
Definitely.
Incredible picks. Yeah, great conversation.
Oh, it's really fun. And you guys, again, great dialogue. Appreciate it.
Yeah. The two halves right there. I think you've summed it up pretty perfectly.
Thank you.
Yeah. That does wrap it up for today, I think, though. Thank you for coming on, Steve. We really appreciate
it. Thanks
for having me. Big thank you to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. But if you're interested at all in hearing music like this or a wide variety of stuff, you can come on down to the record club. You can check out our website. It'll be linked with the show. You'll find any past meetings, future meetings, past playlists, past podcast episodes, themes, anything you'd really need to know, you'll all find it there. Thank you for tuning in, and we appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Love you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.